Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Southwestern Refining versus Cornell.
May it please the court, Mr. Frank Weatherick will present argument from petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. One thing we know about class action litigation in general is that there is an inverse correlation, if you will, between predominance and superiority. The more individual issues predominate given litigation, the less likely it is that class action will be a superior device for managing and resolving that litigation. That is the explicit lesson of the Fifth Circuit's decision in Castano, and we learned that by example in the Jenkins, Raymark, Cimino line of asbestosis decisions. What that means in the context of personal injury litigation is that because individual issues like proximate causation and actual damage will invariably predominate the litigation, it does not matter how you dice it or how you splice it. Those issues will predominate, and because they predominate, class action is not a superior device for managing and resolving the litigation.
Is a class action device never superior in dealing with personal injury claims? Are you saying that as an absolute?
Justice Hankinson, I have given this a great deal of thought. And in all candor, I cannot think of a personal injury case which is truly a superior device for managing that litigation. But if there is such a case, it has to be a mature tort instead of an immature tort. This is a distinction which this court recognized in N. Ray Ethel and N. Ray Bristol Myers. And interestingly, if you read the drafter's comments to the 1995 proposed amendments to Rule 23, the federal class action rule, those comments indicate that based upon interviews with experienced class action trial lawyers throughout the country, men and women who have been doing this for a living for a number of years, the consensus of opinion, according to the drafters, is that to the extent that you might be able to certify any kind of a mass tort, you should not certify mass torts until they are mature. And the case at bar is a classic example of an immature tort. It has never happened before this way. It was a single event. And we submit that because it was a single event, and because none of these claims have been tried, none of these theories have been tested, there have been no appeals, it is a classic immature tort.
In the Shell case that came out of the district court in Louisiana that involved, this is another aspect of it, a single event that gives rise to the injury, that court indicated was another circumstance in which personal injury claims could be appropriately dealt with because you were not dealing with a series of separate events that allegedly caused injury to the members of the class. In what way was the federal district court wrong in Shell in concluding that under Rule 23 you could bring a class action if you had one event? In that case, I believe it was an explosion.
Because, Justice Hankinson, whether you have one event, two events, or a thousand events, it does not matter how you slice it or how you dice it. Castano teaches us that you cannot manufacture predominance through the nimble use of the partial class certification provision in Federal Rule 23, which is the counterpart to our Rule 42D1. And there are two reasons for that. And this ties in with the bifurcation issue in the case of Barr, because I'm going to tell the court this morning that even if you can bifurcate in Texas, even if this court were to overturn Eiley versus Hughes, bifurcation does not get us down the road, and here's why. Number one, if a trial court can manufacture predominance of common issues through, in effect, bifurcating them out and putting them into their own phases of trial, that eviscerates the predominance requirement under the rule. Because in any case where you have common issues, by definition, if you put them into their own phases, they will predominate those phases. But Castano teaches us that you have to look at the case as a whole and determine predominance and superiority first. To create predominance through bifurcation is to put the cart before the horse. Now, why is that important? It is important because, and this is what we learn from the line which started with the promise of Jenkins versus Raymark and ended up with the failure of Cimino versus Raymark. After the bifurcation, after the creative attempts to divide the case out and segregate the common issues, Judge Parker realized at the end that this is not going to work. I cannot try 2,000 or 3,000 mini trials of proximate causation and actual damages. It is an unmanageable mess which the trial court has left on its hands, even if the common issues are tried in their own phase of trial. So it doesn't get you down the road, and that's where N. Ray Shell went wrong. And I think it is important to note, as I think we've noted in our brief, the writ history on N. Ray Shell, because that case was granted en banc review and then settled. And this points out a very important problem with class certification. These cases, I've seen cited not just in the briefs in this case, but in briefs and other class certification appeals, and you see it cited in Texas decisions, that when in doubt, certify, because you can always decertify down the road. Well, besides being in direct contradiction to this court's statement in Bloyette, that if you're not certain, you shouldn't certify, that's what this court held in Bloyette. The anecdotal evidence, Your Honors, is that once these cases are certified, they do not become decertified. And they also don't get tried. What happens is they settle. And why do they settle? They settle because, as Judge Posner originally held in Rompuyn, and as the Fifth Circuit agreed in Castano, it is judicial blackmail. The only case I am aware of, Your Honor, which has been tried is Cimino. And look what happened to Cimino. It was reversed by the Fifth Circuit because the trial judge, and I credit Judge Parker for being hardworking and inventive and was faced with a serious problem in the Eastern District of Texas, and he tried his best. But after he tried the common issues, assuming it was okay to bifurcate those issues out, he realized what a mess he had on his hands, and he changed his plan, and he collectivized proximate causation and actual damages. And the Fifth Circuit rightly noted in Cimino versus Raymark that that is not allowed under Texas substantive law. These issues have to be determined on an individual basis. And unless this court is willing to begin a paradigm shift in the way we practice tort law in this state, I submit that class action litigation is not superior. I cannot conceive of it being superior in a personal injury case. But if it is, it has to be a mature tort. And this brings me to why there are realistic alternatives in this case. And this is an important point. This court has recognized in N. Ray Ethel and N. Ray Bristol Myers and N. Ray Colonial Pipeline just last summer that the trial courts of this state are encouraged to creatively manage their dockets and within discretion to group test plaintiffs for benchmark trials. Now, why is that superior in a case like ours? We have it in the, well, first of all, if you go to a bellwether trial, a mass joinder with a bellwether trial, you are not required to split issues. The court doesn't even need to reach the Eiley versus Hughes issue. You don't have to do damage to that jurisprudence. You don't have to worry about having more than one jury because one jury can handle a bellwether trial. There can be an appeal after the bellwether trial to test error that might occur during the bellwether trial to help mature the tort.
Would you concede that after that bellwether trial, if you lost it, you'd be collaterally stopped from relitigating negligence?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I've thought about that. In fact, the last case I argued up here was a collateral estoppel case, and I lost it because the court found that the issue was not fully and fairly litigated in the original proceeding. That got me to thinking. The short answer is it depends, and let me explain what I mean. In the bellwether trial, depending upon how the issues are submitted to the jury, if those whatever issues we lose on, if they are fully and fairly litigated, then under this court's jurisprudence, you'd have a good argument for issue preclusion in that kind of a case. And I can at least see negligence being fully and fairly litigated in a bellwether trial. I don't see it being fully and fairly litigated in phase one of the current trial plan because you are splitting negligence from proximate cause and from damages, which is a violation of Eiley for a good reason. It's a violation because these are core elements of a tort. Core elements of a negligence tort. And I would remind the court that negligence is not the only theory under which the class is seeking recovery in this case. We don't agree that those other theories are available, but I think the plaintiffs have to live with them now at this juncture. They are also suing us for an unreasonably dangerous activity under strict liability, toxic trespass, and nuisance. And it defies me to figure out a way that you can separate for a jury the question of whether, for instance, we have engaged in an unreasonably dangerous activity if you don't also allow that jury to consider what resulted from it. Or nuisance. How do you determine an unreasonable interference with a person, assuming that that's available, without knowing what happened? To whom? Is it a nuisance as to the guy who was 10 miles away at the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station? Is it an unreasonably dangerous activity as to the man who was in prison in Beaumont? Or was it negligence with respect to the lady in the house on Ebony Street a few blocks away?
Well, why wouldn't you have that same problem, assuming you had a bellwether trial and you lost it, and you fully and fairly litigated unreasonably dangerous issues, all these issues, and you lost on all of them? Wouldn't that be the same problem, I guess, when the subsequent trials came along?
All I can say, Justice Owen, is that it might be because I can see an argument that even in a bellwether trial, while it might have been fully and fairly litigated with respect to the bellwether plaintiffs, for the reasons I just cited, it might not be fully and fairly litigated as to the guy, with respect to the guy at the Naval Air Station 10 miles away. But let's put this in context. That is not an argument for having a class action. Because if that's a problem with bellwether trials as well as class action, that has nothing to do with the other aspects of a bellwether trial, which may get superior to a class action. My point being, there are consequences to allowing class certification of personal injury litigation. Dominoes begin to fall. And I want to make sure that the court understands what those consequences are. Because
Texas is, I think, the only state that has the Eiley versus Hughes doctrine, or it's close to the only state. Are you contending that in the other states, there's simply no way to get a fair adjudication for a finder of fact to make a meaningful determination of an appropriate result in a...
No, Your Honor, I'm not making that argument. There are obvious, I mean, in this democracy of ours, it's a great experiment, and there are different ways to do things. But the fact remains that I think Eilley was decided in the mid-50s, and for all of these years, it has been the policy of this court and the policy of this state to not segregate core elements of a personal injury case. Now, this court has the power to undo Eilley if it wants to. But why should it? Because class action is not necessary. We can get down the road. We can move the ball down the field with realistic alternatives that don't require this court to revisit Eilley, to deal with the successive jury problem, to deal with the problem of how do you settle these cases. For instance, we pointed out in our brief that we are locked in to a class action format now. And I invite the court to look at this from the perspective of the plaintiffs and the defendants. We suspect that most of these claims lack merit. There might be a few that have merit. Shouldn't we be allowed to settle those cases that have merit without it being an all or nothing proposition where we have to somehow realize a quote-unquote aggregate value for 904 claims, most of which probably don't have merit?
Mr. Weatherwood, would you go back very quickly since your time is up? You started to tell us about realistic alternatives. Would you quickly run down your list and give us what the pieces of that realistic alternative list are?
I think what you would do, Your Honor, is you would, plaintiffs and defendants, if they could not agree, would go to the trial court, and the trial court would select a representative grouping of test plaintiffs for a bellwether trial at which you would try top to bottom, backwards and forwards, all of the issues for that group, everything from negligence through punitive damages if that was called for. At the end of that trial, if there were errors, such as Dalbert issues, or the issues of whether toxic trespass even applies, is it a recognized theory of recovery, we would then be allowed to appeal to test, or the plaintiffs could appeal and test, mature the tort, at which time I predict that the writing would start to be on the wall for both sides, and probably the cases would settle on a reasonable basis, not on an aggregate basis. But if to the extent they did not settle, then you could try another group, and possibly even another group. But it's difficult for me to believe that this would make it past two or three test cases. And what that does for you is that it allows you to get around the one jury problem. One jury can do this. You don't have to split the issues. Settlement can proceed on an individual basis. You give maturity and contour to the tort. The parties begin to understand what we're talking about here. Is there a value? What is the value? And start settling these cases. I submit that that is far superior to locking us in to a class action procedure that was not intended for this kind of litigation and would require this court to change the law, not only with respect to Eilley versus Hughes, but successive juries and questions like that.
And you believe that to be true regardless of the size of the individual personal injury damages? In other words, with regard to an asbestos claim or some other claim where some damages could be in excess of $1 million, others could be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. What if individual damages claims are less than a couple of $100, maybe even some around $100? Would a bellwether trial be meaningful? And even if it pointed out that each individual claim is worth $250, are we to have groupings of five cases, then the aggregate damages would be less than $2,000 and then try all 900 of them?
Well, Your Honor, on the end of the spectrum you began with, if you have large damages, I think history shows those folks are going to opt out of a class action, probably, because they don't want to be lumped in.
What about the small damages?
Okay.
In other words, what the point I'm trying to make is your scenario seems pretty interesting, unless, of course, we're dealing with minuscule damages, in which case it would be fairly meaningless scenario.
Well, and that's a distinction that I want to draw for the court, Justice Abbott. There is a distinction between valid claims that happen to be small, your classic class action scenario, consumer rip-offs and things like that, where you've got culpable conduct, no question about it, valid claims, but they happen to be small. That's a good case for a class action, assuming the damages are amenable to a formula-based distribution matrix. But when you talk about personal injury damages, there's a distinction between damages that are valid but small and damages that are underneath the radar screen because they're not valid in the first place. And that's why class action is not superior, because the defendants can't look at these claims individually. We can't separate the invalid claims from the valid claims. That's where their negative value argument falls down, because they are locking us in to an aggregate settlement which does nothing but amount to judicial blackmail. And so, to the extent that the trial court can, this is all in the process of picking representative plaintiffs for these test cases. That's the trial court's discretion, that's the trial court's call within his discretion to pick the appropriate plaintiffs for the bellwether cases. Your Honor, I have no problem with telling this court that there are certain claims that our tort system was not intended to compensate. They are not valid claims that happen to be small. They are claims that are small or nothing because they're not valid. And you can't use a class action procedure to make invalid claims valid. And that's one of the serious problems with class certification in personal injury cases, because those damages differ so much from individual to individual, and you can't get around that, no matter how you slice it, no matter how you dice it.
Counsel, when you come back on rebuttal, I know that you'll be answering in part what the respondent says, but also I want to hear your best shot on why this court has jurisdiction.
Very good, Your Honor.
Any other questions? The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Andres Herrera will present argument to the respondent.
May I please the court? Good morning. My name is Andres Herrera, and I represent the respondents in this matter. The law is where public policy and history intersect with the problems of real people. The law is also where society formulates rules for the fair and efficient administration of justice and for the adjudication of controversies. In this case, there are two fundamental overriding issues. One, whether Rule 42 should be limited and restricted in such a fashion so as to prevent Texas trial courts from having the ability to certify cases, mass action cases, where a personal injury has occurred. And two, whether Section D of Rule 42 should be eviscerated so as to prevent Texas trial courts from having the ability to properly manage their dockets and to properly choose to certify certain issues and not certify other issues. I would respectfully submit to the court that the answer to these two overriding and fundamental issues should be no, for two reasons, both based on the state of the law as it is today and also on practical considerations. And sometimes those two things are the same, and that's true in this case as well. But before I get into a discussion of those issues. Justice Phillips, I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue in this case. It is respondent's position that this matter should not be before this court at this time, and that this court, in fact, lacks jurisdiction over this case at this time. The petitioners base jurisdiction in this matter on Texas Government Code Sections 22.001A2 and Government Code 22.225C. And they claim that this court has jurisdiction over this matter because the Court of Appeals decision in this case is in conflict with the Court of Appeals decision from Dallas in the RSR case. Nothing could be further from the truth. And it's clear from the Coastal Corporation case versus Garza that this case does not conflict with RSR. In Coastal Corporation versus Garza, Justice Enoch, writing for the majority, found three reasons why the Garza case did not conflict with RSR. The second of those reasons was that in the Garza case, there was a complex subclass structure. And by the mere fact of that complex subclass structure, that case was legally distinct from the RSR case and could not be found to conflict with it. In this case, in the Southwestern Refinery case, you have a complex subclass structure. You have a trial court which has created a three-phase trial plan and has separated the case into various classes and has classified certain issues and not classified other issues.
Not the members of the class.
No, the members of the class have not been placed into various subclasses.
As in
Your
Coastal.
Honor. I'm sorry?
As in Coastal.
As in Coastal. But it does contain a classification of certain issues and not a classification of other issues, of the individualized damage issues. So based on the Garza case, I don't think that this court has jurisdiction because of a conflict with another court of appeals. The next ground that is cited by the petitioners for jurisdiction.
You don't think that this court, that SCA that certified a class involving personal injuries is not in conflict with the Court of Appeals in Dallas that didn't certify because involved personal injury?
Well, Your Honor, if y'all have this exhibit handout that I brought today, I'd like to refer the court to tab 3 of these exhibits. And while I agree with Justice Enoch's majority opinion in the Coastal Corp versus Garza case, I also think that Justice Heck had it right, where he said, no fair reading of RSR can conclude that the class certification was reversed because plaintiffs asserted personal injury claims. I don't think that the reason that RSR was not upheld or that the class was not upheld by the Court of Appeals was because it was a personal injury case. I think it's clear.
You'll
that
notice that dissent.
Yeah, it was in the dissent.
Did you carry the dissent?
That's why I said I like the opinions.
It was right then and wrong now.
Can I do that? That case was not, the certification was not overturned because it was a personal injury case. In fact, Justice Heck, you point out that the personal injury issues were only addressed in one short paragraph after the court had decided that the case did not meet the prerequisites for class certification. So I don't think that you can say that these cases conflict because they involve personal injury. The other ground that the petitioner cites as the basis for jurisdiction before this court is the conflict between the decision from the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi and this court's opinions in Eiley and this court's opinion in Morial and some of their sister cases. And I'll get into that further along in my argument, but I'd like to just discuss at this point a little bit of why I think there's a very practical reason that this case should not be before the court at this time. The class action rule and both federal and state precedents clearly discusses this is a very fluid rule. It's a rule which allows the trial court to decertify. It allows the trial court to modify the certification. It allows the trial court to subclassify. And I think that there should be the right to one interlocutory appeal to the Court of Appeals to make a determination initially as to whether or not the fundamental aspects of the class certification rule have been fulfilled. But once it reaches that level, it should not come to this court because the trial court could change its mind.
You don't think there's a direct conflict between trying punitive damages before actual damages and Morial?
Well, that's not what is occurring in this case, Your Honor. I think that what's occurring in the trial plan in this case is that the trial judge is going to allow the jury to make a finding of whether or not gross negligence has occurred. And if I could refer you to tab 10 of the handout which I gave, I've reduced the trial plan as modified by the Court of Appeals in that exhibit. And you'll notice that in phase one, the trial court, the jury is to determine whether or not gross negligence occurred. Now, that does not mean that there's going to be a determination as to whether there were punitive damages, just whether or not there was malice or the standard for gross negligence as cited or as instructed in Moriel has been achieved. And then in phase two, the jury will determine whether or not there was actual damages which were incurred by the class representatives. And only after actual damages have been determined for the class representatives, so that the jury can link punitives with actuals, which is the precedence in Texas, only after the actual damages will the jury have the ability to make a determination as to the level of punitive damages. And that is in complete compliance with Moriel, because reasoning behind Moriel was that, one, you have to link punitive damages with actual damages, and two, you cannot put in evidence as to the net worth of a company prior to a determination.
Okay, but what about this problem? That is, one of the elements of negligence is that it most approximately caused damage.
That's correct. That's correct.
So you're divorcing or segregating that element out in phase one. You're saying in phase one they're going to determine negligence. How can they do that without hitting that other aspect?
The proximate cause aspect of negligence will be determined for the class representatives in phase two.
But you're saying they will determine negligence in phase one with proximate cause of damages being an element of negligence. How can they determine negligence without hitting all the causes or elements of the cause of action?
They can determine negligence because what they're determining is whether or not Southwestern Refinery and the other defendants in this case engaged in conduct which reaches the level of liable conduct in what they did at this refinery. They're not determining whether it's caused injury. They're not making that determination in the first phase, and so it's not negligence as a whole. It's a determination of liability of the defendants, and you will not have negligence so as to allow a recovery until the jury makes the determination as to proximate causation and damages in the second phase.
Why is it a superior way to try this, these cases? Why shouldn't you have a bellwether trial all the issues and then see where you are? You've got collateral estoppel if you prevail.
Well, I don't think you do have collateral estoppel, Your Honor. I think that the defendants are never going to concede that the bellwether trial is binding. They'll find a reason to argue that collateral estoppel does not apply.
On what basis?
They can argue in the same basis for the case that was cited by petitioner, that the underlying facts for a particular class member are different than for another class member, and therefore collateral estoppel should not apply.
What's that got to do with the liability issue? That makes it such proximate cause. What's that got to do with the liability issue? Why wouldn't it?
Well, I think when you're looking at the superiority of the class action device, not only do you have to look at whether or not there are other available means for trying the case, but I think you also need to look at whether or not you have what is called a negative value suit.
How long is this class action, the way you structure it? How long does it take to get that trial done?
I can't give you an approximation at the time, but I think it can be done for one jury. It's clear
how long?
That it could be, I have no idea how long it would take, but I would imagine that you could do it within 6 to 8 weeks.
Do you
904 claims of causation in 6 to 8 weeks?
Well, we presented to the trial judge the possibility of reviewing the individual damages through what are called damage brochures, or other manners in which to present the information in a very succinct format so that the jury can get through it quickly.
Do you then disagree with the Fifth Circuit in Cimino that Texas law requires individualized determinations, meaning individualized trials, of proximate cause and damages as to each individual plaintiff?
No, I do not.
So, in fact, you're going to have 903 individualized determinations by a jury as to proximate cause and damages, where you have to fully meet all the usual proof requirements under Texas law.
That's correct, but why should we also have 903 determinations as to whether or not Southwestern Refinery was negligent in the manner it maintained this refinery, or why, or whether it properly trained the individuals who were maintaining the refinery?
Why doesn't a bellwether trial help you get that done?
Because a bellwether trial is not contemplated under the rules of procedure of Texas, and there's no...
We do them all the time.
But there's no requirement that it's going to bind the defendants.
We've got collateral estoppel on the book. Well, I'm kind of surprised when you say it doesn't apply.
Well, let me ask you...
I just think it gives them some wiggle room. And the class
action...
Take
it up on appeal, and we'll see if they wiggle or not. And then, assuming it applies, what's wrong with that?
But the class doesn't have that problem. That's why we have class actions. We have class actions to resolve issues once.
Are you aware
when they're
of
common to the class? And if you fulfill the requirements of Rule 42, if you fulfill the requirement of numerosity, typicality, commonality, adequacy of representation, and then you fulfill one of the deemed requirements...
What case could not be subject to class action if you're committed to segregate discrete issues? In any... a 25-car pileup on the highway, or a plane crash, or any sort of catastrophe that occurs out there, why wouldn't any of those cases be eligible for class action status by simply saying we're going to look at the discrete event, declare a class for anybody who was affected by that event, and the only thing we're going to try is negligence, the liability issue. And once that's tried, that's a final judgment in the class action, and now we're going to go back and try 900, 1,000, 2,000 individual cases with this as the predicate. Seems to me that's... Why wouldn't every accident be eligible for a class action?
We're not doing that exactly in this case. We're trying the individualized damage issues to one jury, to the same jury that makes a determination as to the liability issues. But I think that the answer to your question is that if those cases fit within the requirements of Rule 42 and evidence is presented to the trial court judge and a motion is made to certify this class, then certainly if it fits within the requirements of Rule 42 and the trial court judge properly applies that evidence to those elements, then it can be a class.
But it seems that was my point back to you. Following your view, every accident is eligible for class action status because you could discreetly declare one event, it meets all the criteria of 42 because this one does, and therefore it's eligible for class action status.
If the elements of Rule 42 have been met, and I think that perhaps I'm saying that the elements of Rule 42 are strong enough to prevent an abuse of the class action procedure in those cases where it is not appropriate, that a trial court judge should carefully analyze the facts of an individual case to determine whether or not the elements of Rule 42 have been met, and then that can be appealed to the Court of Appeals to make a determination as to whether or not it was proper. I think that one of the questions asked in the Ford paint case was whether or not that would create precedent for seatbelt cases or any other type of case that came along in the future and allow that to be certified as class action as well. And I think that in that case, I think it was argued well by the respondent, he tried to distinguish his case as a property damage or diminution in value case from personal injury cases, saying that, well, personal injury cases are completely different from property damage cases and each individual is distinct and you shouldn't be able to certify a personal injury case and that's why this isn't going to happen. Well, I think that's incorrect. I think that you need to look at the individual facts of each case and make a determination as to whether or not it fulfills the requirements of Rule 42.
If these were very serious injuries, would you be here arguing that it should be certified as a class?
No.
Why not?
Because this is a negative value suit where the level of injuries is minor. As Justice Adler was saying, here we have injuries which probably do not exceed for any of the plaintiffs on an individual basis of $1,000. And if they're not allowed to pursue this case as a class action, that's outcome determinative. They're not going to be able to pursue it on an individual basis. And if you look at tab
four.
Why can't they pursue it on individual basis? They were all joined in the same lawsuit.
Well, the reasoning given by Bloyette at tab four is that when you have cases where it's not economically feasible to obtain relief within the traditional framework of multiplicity of small individual suits for damages, then you're getting close to meeting the superiority requirement under 42B. And then that is based on the Castano case, which is the next tab that says the most compelling rationale for finding superiority in a class action is the existence of a negative value suit. And what that means, Your Honor, is that these individuals would not be able to retain counsel. They would not be able to pursue and develop the case in the manner in which they would have to develop it unless they could do it as a group, because the value of the case just does not exist on its own. And therefore, when you have a negative value suit, when you have...
They did join as a group, didn't they? All from the same law?
They did join individually, but with the intention, well, they joined individually into the case, but it would not be possible to handle the case as a consolidated case unless it was done through the class action context.
If we were to say, no, you can't certify this, are you going to dismiss the case?
It's likely that a large number of the claims may be dismissed, yes.
Well, you have referred repeatedly to the fact that requirements of Rule 42 are met, but in answering, it must be the answers to your question, looking at the predominance requirement,
mm-hmm.
I've heard you identify one issue that is common, and that has to do with the fault piece or the breach of the duty piece of negligence. And the individual issues I've heard you mention include the fact and amount of damages, causation, and I think we have talked about it, but there are also certain defenses, I understand, in this case, like limitations, perhaps some comparative fault, whatever. How do you claim that the predominance requirement of Rule 42 is met in the face of all of these individual issues?
Your Honor, I think that you can't line up on one side, you know, one issue and then a whole bunch of issues on the other side. I think what you need to do is look at what is going to be dispositive in the case. If in this case it's determined that Southwestern Refinery is not liable during the liability phase, the case will be over. That would be dispositive of the case. And because it will be dispositive, and I think that this is cited in the Fort Payne case, in the Court of Appeals decision, because the issue will be dispositive, that makes it a predominant issue. Even if you have a series of other individualized issues, it's not a counting match to see how many there are on one side and how many there are on the other side. It's looking at the issues and determining what's going to be dispositive. Here, if in phase one, the trial court or the jury determines that there was no negligence, there was no gross negligence, none of the other courts alleged occurred, then the case is over. And therefore, those issues predominate over the other issues in the case.
Well, but if you win phase one on the negligence and the jury determines there's a breach of the duty, then we are flooded in order to take care of actually disposing of all these claims, 902 or 3 individual determinations of causation, fact and amount of damage, defenses. So how can you say in the face of that, in order to really dispose of the case, you've got to look at all the elements of the cause of action that must be proved, that the one issue that you've got first in your phased trial plan predominates over the other issues?
My point is that...
Don't we have to look at the case, under the case law, look at the case as a whole?
I don't think so, because I think that 42D provides you with the ability to subclassify and to divide the case into different parts.
One Rule 42 is the requirements of Rule 42 for certification are met.
Right, right. And I think that the predominance inquiry goes to whether or not an issue is going to be dispositive or not. And if that issue is dispositive, then it may predominate. And that's what the trial court found in this instance.
What case law do you have to support that interpretation of the predominance requirement?
I think that is discussed in the Ford Motors versus Soldano case as a basis for predominance, and I think that in that case there are citations to other cases, and I would be more than happy to provide the court with those citations after this argument. If I could just briefly discuss why I think this case does not conflict with Eiley.
Does anybody want to hear a question?
All right. Thank you very much.
Let me briefly remark on some comments made by counsel, and then I will address the jurisdiction question, Your Honor. Respondents conceded in response to your question, Justice Hankinson, that you first have to meet the requirements of 42 before you can start carving things up in order to do your class action, in order to manage it. And that's exactly what Castano teaches us, is that 42D1 is a housekeeping provision of Rule 42, which allows the court to carve out the common issues once the court has determined that predominance and superiority are already satisfied. They have conceded that point. Sheldon reasoned, and I couldn't disagree more, Sheldon reasoned that bifurcation is good because what if Ford Motor Company wins phase one? Then it's all over with. Does this court want to enunciate a ruling which justifies certification of cases based upon a gamble, based upon a guess, based upon speculation about who's going to win and who's going to lose, and hope after you toss the dice that it's going to all turn out all right? I don't think that's a sound rule. I don't think the policy supports that kind of a rule. We don't know who's going to win phase one. I would hope that we did. And if we did under this current trial plan, I guess the case would go away. But what if we don't? Then you've got an unmanageable mess on your hands. Which brings me to jurisdiction. Number one, RSR versus Hayes. This court held in Coastal versus Garza that RSR versus Hayes is primarily a personal injury case. That's the explanation for what it did, because it stands for the following legal principle. Individual issues of causation and damages invariably are going to predominate this kind of litigation. The Court of Appeals in the case at bar has held the other way. The Court of Appeals in the case at bar has bought into the argument that you can get around this predominance problem by slicing the case and dicing it. And that is a conflict with RSR. If it's not, I genuinely do not understand what this court meant in Coastal versus Garza. Number two, there is a blatant conflict with Eiley versus Hughes on the issue of separating out, splitting causes of action into their constituent elements for different trials. It is incredulous to me that respondents would tell this court with a straight face that this case can be tried to one jury. I can't fathom how this case could be tried to one jury. So even if you accept the argument that Eiley versus Hughes is a two-jury or a successive jury case and doesn't apply to one jury, we're not going to be able to use one jury in this case. And so you've got a conflict with Eiley on that basis alone. But we submit that Eiley also applies to the one jury situation. That's the way we read the Morreale decision. And quite frankly, I don't understand how you can ask a jury to decide negligence and proximate cause and damages at different phases of the trial. That opens up a whole can of worms, for instance, with respect to broad form submission. It opens up a can of worms with respect to Rule 292 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, that the same 10 jurors have to agree on everything. I don't understand how that works or how it's supposed to work. And that is a conflict between Eiley and this case. And finally, there is a conflict between Morial in this case and the White County Advantage.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.